Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Well, hey, it's the Nerdist Podcast number 345. Come in, take off your shoes, put on a sweater, have a hug. Here's some tea in the form of words. Bunch of shows coming up. I've had so much fun on the road, kind of working the new hour, and it's been fantastic. Madison, Wisconsin was really fun. Caroline's in New York was really fun. And there's a ton more dates coming up, which I don't know if I've announced specifically what they are, but starting very soon, you would have to listen to this within 2 days of the show being posted, but I'm going to be giving a moderated talk at Rutgers University on April 16th, kind of about the Nerdist stuff and the Nerdist Way book, and it's for Rutgers Geek Week, so I believe if you follow at Rutgers Geek Week on Twitter, you can get more information about that. It is a that one's a free show. Then I'm going to be at the Comedy Works in Denver, May 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. I love Comedy Works. It's one of my favorite clubs in the country. It's right in Larimer Square. I went to high school in Denver for a couple years. It's a great town, and I adore it. I believe Skydart will be with me if you want to say hi to her as well. See, I'll use my girlfriend to entice you to come see the shows. May 9th, 10th, and 11th, I will be at Helium in Portland. And then May 15th and 16th at the Leicester Square Theater in London. Then May 24th, Rams Head in Baltimore, Maryland. May 25th, the 9:30 Club in D.C. And then some shows in June. I think I might be coming to Philadelphia, but I don't know exactly just yet. So hold on that, and then I'll announce more as I get them. But if you go to Nerdist.com/calendar, you can get information on that. Yes, I will come after the show. Yes, I will hug you if you want, or I don't have to. Maybe you don't want me in your personal space, but at least I'll come out and say hi, and thank you very much for coming to the show and supporting all the Nerdist stuff. Speaking of supporting the Nerdist stuff, oh my God, what a segue. See, I fucked it up because I just said, hey, what a segue, and acknowledging the segue ruins the segue. It's the Heisenberg principle of segues. But Stamps.com is a sponsor for this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. It is 24/7 access to all the services from the post office that you would need right at your desk or your bed or wherever. Maybe you have a lap desk. I don't know how you work, but wherever your computer is, you will have access to your very own post office. You'll print exactly the postage you need. You never have to overpay for postage. You never have to go to the post office again. Your mail carrier will pick everything up. Stamps.com is phenomenal. Phenomenal. And there's a no-risk trial for Nerdist users, $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and up to $55 of free postage. Go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Nerdist. Stamps.com, enter the promo code Nerdist. This gentleman, I've only recently kind of become pals with him, but what a terrific guy. And I know what your comments are going to be on the website. Oh, another terrific guest. Yeah, asshole, another terrific guest. Because I get to talk to a lot of really nice, cool, fun people. And this guy is definitely the opposite of a jerk. It's Dominic Monaghan. He is so fucking cool. I mean, even just his accent alone is just like, it's just like gravy. It's just like buttery gravy in your ears. I mean, even if you didn't listen to the words he was saying and the wonderful things that he had to say and talk about the stuff that he's worked on, if you just tune those out and just listen to his accent, you could be like, my ears have been fed all day. I feel like I've had a delicious country breakfast for my ears. It's like a Cracker Barrel for your ear canals. is Dominic Monaghan. I may be getting a little off point here, but you can follow Dom at Dom's Wild Things on Twitter, and then we reveal that there's a particular movie that Dom's looking for that if you can find, he will give you a special treat, which we talk about in the podcast. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about Lost, maybe we'll talk a little bit about Lord of the Rings, maybe we'll talk a little bit about animals. So also I should mention that his show Wild Things on BBC America is super cool. He is a lifelong animal lover and basically tours the world looking at animals that he's always wanted to see in person. And it's the show's really fun. So check it out on BBC America. And here you go, the Nerds Podcast number 345 with Dominic Monaghan.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Dominic Monaghan, finally on the podcast. Oh my gosh. It's been, you know, we were supposed to record with you last week, and then Chloe got very sick and had to go to the hospital, and I had to cancel on you an hour before.
Yep.
And I was worried that the girlfriend thing sounded like a made-up excuse, but it really was the reason. And you were very cool about it, so I appreciate that.
It did not
that.
Sound like a made-up excuse. And to in the spirit of full disclosure, I was actually watching a Champions League game at the time. When I found out it was cancelled, I was like, oh, the football gods have answered me. This is brilliant. So I didn't want to give you too much.
Why did the football gods make Chloe sick? Why are you using this power? It's sort of the Faustian clause. Yeah. You know, like,
no, it was
could
great.
You please just let me watch this? Everyone in your neighborhood has been in an accident. No!
You know, you get kind of relaxed in your house and you're thinking, okay, I could make some food for myself. I could, put the kettle on, but I can't because I have to leave in 40 minutes. Yeah. And then it came through that, you know, I wasn't going to do the podcast. I was like, sweet, I'm going to chill out. My
so
night's done. So
what happened with your footballing?
What was the football? It was Champions League, so it would have been quarterfinal. I mean, Manchester United, my team, are not in it. They got knocked out in the previous round. But I obviously watched the Champions League, so I can't remember who it was. It was like, it would have been either Real Madrid or Barcelona, I would have thought.
So when you're watching a, what you guys call it, what the rest of the world calls a football match.
Because we use our feet to kick the ball.
Because you use your feet to kick your ball, not your hands.
As opposed to you guys with this
handball sounds
catch
dumb, though.
Thing.
Catch yeah. ball. Should
yeah,
be catch
yeah.
ball.
True, true.
Catch ball and occasionally kick ball.
Yeah.
What is it that you're seeing? What are you locking into? What are you connecting with in that match?
Well, I think one of the disconnects that happens in the States, not with everyone, because it is a growing sport and people are liking it more and more, and I think as American teams continue to get better and better, the fan base will get bigger. I think what a lot of people disconnect with is people kind of say, oh, okay, so it's 90 minutes with a break in between, one break in between. So 45 minutes of sport, break, 45 minutes of sport. And the game can end 1-0, which essentially means there's one piece of action. But that's not in any way true, because what you've got is one goal, obviously, but then you've got battles occurring on different parts of the field. You might have a really, really fantastic winger, someone who runs up and down the sides of the pitch, going up against a really, really tough defender. So that's like a little battle on the pitch that you're watching. Can the defender stay close to that guy? Is he strong enough? Will he have to foul him? All this kind of stuff. You've got battles in midfield. You know, Barcelona are known for dominating the pitch in the middle of the pitch. So they basically have the ball in the middle of the pitch and you can't get it off them. Now, if you, as a team like Manchester United, say, well, we actually own the midfield as well. What you then get is the ball moving very, very fast in the center of the pitch and people trying to like steal it off each other. And, you know, it's a culmination. It's a buildup of drama. You also might get a team like, you know, any team, but certainly teams like Barcelona, Real Madrid, Manchester United, Juventus, they might pass the ball purposefully 20 to 30 times on purpose just to look for gaps. Who's weak? What defender's injured? Who's not running? Who's not good? And then utilize that little weakness to create a goal. What happens in American sports is, you know, obviously American football, you know, first down and 10, whatever, you have to, there's a piece of drama occurring right there and then. They either make it to that place or the other team push them back and they don't quite make it. And that that piece of drama is like 20 or 30 seconds. In basketball, they have 24 seconds to shoot the basket, the ball. So then you've got 24 seconds is going to be a piece of drama. I think the miseducation that goes on in football or soccer in America is because there isn't a piece of noticeable action every 30 seconds, nothing's actually happening. But a lot of things are happening, you know, a lot of little pieces of dramas are playing out. It's a okay. subtle game.
So whereas an American might look at soccer and go, that game should be called Almost Goal because it's a lot of almost scoring.
It is.
But that's where all the action lies. I mean, you watch the couple times that I've actually been in a bar or restaurant, I've seen it on the screen. It looks like a fucking hard sport because you're just running up back and forth on a massive field.
Yeah. I mean, the average professional footballer, I think, runs over 12 kilometers a game. They're all incredibly fit. And what I like about footballers is when you look at their level of fitness, they have fantastic cardio, they have good physical strength, but they're not overly big in different areas. You know, American footballers, you might have like huge shoulders and tiny legs, or basketball players are 8 feet tall with massive shoulders and arms, but their legs aren't big. Soccer players, football players, have a fantastically balanced system. You know, their cardio's great. They might not be the most intelligent person off the pitch, but their football in mind, how they understand the game, the quickness of how they read the game is you know, really, really impressive. And, you know, they have, you know, strong bodies. They look good. I mean, have you seen David Beckham with his shirt off?
He's a handsome man.
He's definitely a handsome
man. He's ripped.
He is ripped for sure.
Have you ever found yourself in a soccer riot?
I've been taken into custody, I think is a good way to say it. I don't think my lawyer's on the other line.
Murdered? Is that the correct word?
I need to be careful with my words. I was involved. Yeah, that's not true. Let me back up for a second. I was in a crowd of people that were involved in a fracas at a football game. And Manchester United has the most amount of people go into a game in any week in England. There's over 75,000 people go to a game.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so when you leave a game, I've been with people before who've lost their shoes. If you're not walking correctly and someone stands on your feet, there's no scenario where you can turn around and walk the other way. It's a sea of people.
Oh,
walking.
Wow.
So I was in a sea of people that were involved in, you know, a little bit of argy-bargy with away fans and coppers, and the coppers just surrounded what was probably 40 to 60 people and just took us all away.
I love your use of the term coppers, by the way.
Coppers,
it's
yeah.
Very it's very steampunk. I like
we
it.
We do say coppers. I know you guys say cops, and I will say cops in the States, but we will say copper, you know. We will say like I was talking on my phone in the car, and I didn't mean to, and I pulled up next to a copper. Like we don't say it to be twee. We actually do say it.
I also like the word twee. Listen, I think you need to do an episode of Dom's Wild Things coming out of a football match.
Yeah, man.
And just grab different fans and try to interact with them. Like, oh, sure, this one's sleeping, and yeah. It's like the guy's passed out, like the yeah. biggest soccer thug.
Well, we integrate a little bit of football in every episode, and I wanted the integration of football to feel very varied in its elements, whether I'm playing a pickup game with kids on the street, or whether I actually show up at a game. And one of the other things that we wanted to do and that we will do is go to a legitimate game, you know, go to Barcelona and watch Barcelona play Real Madrid, and I mean, that's, you know, 100,000 people, and it's Jesus. A huge rivalry, and you know, it's a big deal. It's you know, half of the city's annoyed, the other half of the city's celebrating for the rest of the night, you know. So we will do that. What's interesting with me and footy is that it's transcended the sport for me, you know. Like, I really enjoy basketball out here. I love the Olympics. I'll watch a little bit of golf if I've got some free time, and I'm, you know, I've got like a couple of hours, I'm not doing anything. Wimbledon, I'll watch the big major events. But the thing with football is because it's so part of my upbringing and my personality and stuff like that. It sounds contrived to say it's more than a sport, but it's almost, I put it in a different category than sport for me. It's like lifestyle. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like travel, or it's like food, or something like that. It's something that is always a part of me. I mean, I check in with certain things on my phone every day, and one of those things is a Manchester United website and just a general football website. I always know what's going on in the world of football, and outside of the actual games itself, it's who they talking about being sold from your team, who they talking about being transferred into your team, when your manager's going to leave, what the media is saying about your manager, what they're saying about your players, rumours. You know, this guy that used to play for Manchester United, who now plays for Manchester City, just today avoided a jail sentence because he pleaded guilty to driving with a disqualified license. Like, that really has nothing to do with footy, but it's always in my wheelhouse because I'm so interested in it.
That's as bad as it gets, that he was driving without an updated license?
I think what had happened was I think he'd committed some sort of maybe speeding offense or driving offense, and he was banned from driving, and he drove while he was banned from driving.
That, I mean, that our athletes have dogs attack each other, they get caught with steroids, drugs, beating up people, smacking around their spouses. And you're like, well, so when you were leading up that story, you're like, well, this is a really big story. Get this. He was driving with an expired license.
Well, they did. I mean, you know, some footy, I'm not going to name and shame players, but some footy players have done some pretty outrageous stuff in the past. But, you know, they are our superstars. And we don't really have that much competition for other sports. We have, you know, you guys have American football, basketball, what, like golf, hockey,
golf, baseball, hockey, tennis. But you guys have tennis too. But yeah, you have cricket. Too. We don't really have much of a trace.
I know a lot of American people have a hard time swallowing soccer, but I mean, cricket, you can watch a game play a game for 5 days and it can end in a fucking draw. You're like, what?
God, I have just wasted
5 days and no one gets to win? Like, what the fuck is going on here, you know? But that's people are so flummoxed by cricket in America, and it's essentially baseball, but the rules are just slightly tweaked. I mean, you know, the cricketer holding the bat is protecting 3 pieces of wood behind him. If you hit those pieces of wood and knock off a smaller piece of wood on top of them, he's out.
It's like baseball. Everyone's better dressed. There are Indian people, and everyone looks generally more educated.
Yeah, and there are some absolutely fascinating things that go on in cricket, like. Obviously, you've got the bowlers who are trying to get the batsman out. You have a fast bowler who is basically a guy who runs as fast as he can and throws the ball as fast as he can at you call them stumps, which the bales sit on. Then you have slow bowlers. Now, a slow bowler will bowl the ball slow, but he'll spin the ball. You have what's called a leg spin, which is a spin where the ball will bounce, and then as it hits the ground, it'll spin towards your legs. Then you have an off spin, which is where the ball will bounce, and it'll spin away from your legs. Then you have what's called a googly. Do you know what a googly is?
No.
A googly.
Isn't that where someone sucks their finger and then like jams it into your ear?
That's a wet willy, right?
That is a wet willy, but it also sounds like it might be a googly.
A googly is where the bowler shows the cricketer what he's going to do, but then does the exact opposite. So they have that in baseball, right? Like the guy will almost kind of pantomime that he's going to throw something in baseball, but it's the exact opposite. You have that in baseball?
I don't. I'm sure there are names for it. I'm sure it's like a changeup or a slider, but I don't know.
Yeah, slidery type.
I don't know what any of those terms are.
A googly is amazing. If you can spin a googly when you're a kid, like if you play cricket, pick up cricket with your friends, and you know someone who can throw a googly, that's pretty impressive. Like, it's like a card trick. You're going, hey, ace of spades, and they go, okay, cool. And you go, no, jack of diamonds.
I feel like... That sounds very fancy. I think in America, that would just mean that the pitcher pitched at the guy's balls. Just like throw it right at the guy's balls.
That happens. I've seen that in baseball where they throw it right at him and he pull off the helmet and run towards him.
And then the dugout's empty and then all of a sudden it's a big mayhem.
I can't believe the baseball players are the more highly paid sportsmen in America, whereas basketball and American football seems to have much more of a presence for me.
Well, basketball players are pretty well paid. Football players, yeah, I don't know. I do know that baseball players, though, there are some guys that's like, oh, he's got $120 million.
Yeah.
Is it capitalized in that way with football players in England, or is there sort of a general, are they well paid but not like astronomically well paid?
Well, I mean, to be the top in your team, international players like David Beckham or Wayne Rooney or Ryan Giggs or, you know, these superstars like Lionel Messi, Cristiano Ronaldo. I mean, I'm going to guess someone like Messi probably earns something like $700,000 a week.
Oh, and, wow.
Yeah. I mean, he banks. And then he also is sponsored by Nike and Adidas.
So they're making a shit ton of money, too.
They are making an inordinate amount of money. I mean, there's a reason why soccer or football is called the world's game. I mean, you know, all of South America plays it. All of Europe plays it.
Well, wait,
all
I don't
of
understand
Africa
then.
Plays it.
Because then, well, that can't be true because baseball in America is the World Series.
Right.
So we are playing. I mean, it's amazing that every year teams from this country compete in the World Series, but I think that's just how good we are.
Yeah, I'm always impressed that it seems that every year an American team wins the World Series. I mean, that is phenomenal.
I know there's a dumb reason for that, that I'm sure it's like, well, in the 1920s, that's because blah, blah, blah. I'm sure there's a reason for it.
Well, you
so got, I don't care what it is, so no one has to tell me online, like, this is why.
Right. We're being facetious. Also, in the NBA, you become the world champions, right? But they're not playing against, like, Spain and Greece and
Turkey
and Brazil.
That one we'd probably win at, I think we're pretty good at basketball.
Although the Slavic teams are good, right? Like, I didn't realize that countries like Russia and the Czech Republic and Slovenia and all these places are good basketball teams.
They just have these giant, like, 10-foot hulks.
Yeah. Andre the Giant type people.
Just...
Hey, let's talk Twitter, because you really helped me out with my Twitter.
Did I help you out on Twitter? Okay.
We
At Dom's Wild Things.
At Dom's Wild Things on Twitter. Yeah, I recognize that you had a phenomenal presence on Twitter, and I was like, how do you do that? And you said a few real succinct points about it. You were like, well, one of the major things that makes sense with your tweeting is that you do it regularly so that people know that they can check in and you've got some activity going on.
Sure.
I also realized that photos are a big thing. Like, if you send a photo, it'll usually get retweeted because people want... It's an easy way to...
They'll pass it around, yeah. And especially where you're going and what you're doing, you must have an incredible library of photographs.
Yeah, I've got a ton of stuff. And then it's also the amount of times that you're retweeted. It's like a bacterial effect, right? Like, you get retweeted, it hits everyone else. Then they retweet, it hits all their people. Then they retweet, it hits all their people, you know? I had said to people a long time ago, when I hit 100,000 followers, I think I'm on like 93,000 now, I'll post up some photos of Lord of the Rings pictures that no one's ever seen. And then I'll keep doing that. Like, when I reach benchmark moments, 250, 500,000, a million.
Now, you know what I like about that is that sometimes, you know, when you see people go, this doesn't happen as much anymore, but certainly when Twitter first started to get popular, people would go, if I get 50,000 followers, I'm going to donate $1,000 to charity. And then people go, well, if you have that money, why don't you just give it to charity? You know, like, but to say, like, hey, here's sort of like a bonus thing, like Lord of the Rings picture. That's fucking cool.
Yeah, yeah. It's fun. I struggle with Twitter here and there. Like, I think I have a few things about Twitter that I don't like. One of my least favorite things is yesterday, for example, I have this lighter that I don't smoke, but I have this lighter that I use if I ever need to light candles or anything like that. And it's a super cool lighter and it broke. So I posted up some photos yesterday on Twitter and I was like, hey guys, like, this broke. I'm not really sure how. Do you guys have any idea how I could fix it and, like, who I would go and see and stuff?
The Twitter genie.
The Twitter genie. And everyone's, like, helping me out and stuff like that. And then someone said, oh, you have a lighter. Do you smoke? And I wrote back, no, I don't smoke. I have a favorite lighter. It's like a gadget. When I travel, sometimes I need to make fire and stuff like that. 10 minutes later, someone else writes, oh, do you smoke? I was like, no, I don't smoke. Like, there's something about... someone will only look at the last two or three tweets that you do. They'll never... look back at your stuff. And I'll do Q&As all the time, and guaranteed 50 to 60% of the tweets will be questions that I always get asked or questions that I've just answered.
That definitely happens. But also, if you're just directly at replying people, those tweets are not visible unless that person is following both of you, unless they go to the timeline that is all of your tweets, but that's not a default. Like, if someone just goes to your profile page, they're going to see public tweets, or they're going to see tweets are going to show up in their timeline that are only people that they're following. Mm. So that was something that it didn't used to be that way. And then Twitter condensed it to keep the timelines a little bit cleaner.
So what would I do? Let's say I'm doing a Q&A and someone says, what was your favorite scene in Lord of the Rings? And I wanted everyone to know about it. Do I take off the personal name of the person who tweeted that and just answer the question?
There are a couple of ways. If it's a short answer, you can, and, you know, surprisingly, there's no way to do this from Twitter directly, but you're essentially you're quoting the tweet and then answering it. So you'll answer in the front part and then you'll see the retweet of the question is one way to do it. So that everyone sees the question and the answer. But if it's a longer answer and you can't fit it on 140 characters, then you might just say, via and then the user's name.
Right.
And then you just put the answer in there. Right. You can also put a period in front of, if you're just replying directly to someone and that's the first thing in your tweet, you can put a period in front of that, which keeps the username from being the first thing in the tweet, which then makes it public and visible to everyone.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
So that's something.
And then how come I see people tweet a ton of characters and I can only do 140? What's that about?
Well, some people have they can use an apps, the apps that are like tweet longer, and then it'll tweet longer, and then there'll be, you know, an ellipse, and then it'll take you to the full tweet.
Right.
So, but in general, you're, you know,
that's what it is. And then another frustrating thing is if someone asks you a question and the question is relatively long.
Yeah.
I'll sometimes take that question because I want to answer it correctly and slightly tweak that question, not change the question, but they might write something like, "Hey, I heard you're going on the Nerdist. Please tell Chris I said hello.
Sure.
What's your favorite thing about doing a podcast?" So I might take out, "Please tell Chris I said hello," so that I can answer correctly. And the person gets annoyed. They're like, "Why'd you change my question?"
And I can help you with that.
Like, I only have 140 characters.
I'll help you with that. You write RT before you want to retweet something. And if you change anything in their tweet, you write MT, which means modified tweet.
Oh, okay.
So you're saying, "I've modified this tweet in some way, MT colon, you know, their username and their whatever you've modified from them."
All right.
Which is generally just a courtesy of saying, like, "I took liberties with this person's tweet, so I just want to make sure that people know that I'm not representing it 100% the way that they wrote it."
I tweaked the tweet.
Yes. Yes.
So MT.
It's a tweet tweak. Yeah, MT, modified tweet.
What's your favorite thing about Twitter?
My favorite thing about it has been connecting with people. I mean, basically getting people on the podcast, connecting with people, finding out people that I really like and respect might be following me, so then I can connect with them and say, "Hey, do you want to come on the pod?" Like, it's been a really great way to connect with people that I always want. I mean, what Twitter was supposed to do, like people that I wanted to meet, or like connecting with you on Twitter, or connecting with, you know, whoever else. It's actually helped me get to know a lot of people that I don't think I would have gotten to know otherwise. Yeah. Get them on the podcast, get them on the shows, just be pals with them online.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite footballers growing up, Gary Lineker, who is an England international, follows me on Twitter.
Yeah, so there you go.
Bret Easton Ellis, one of my favorite authors of all time, follows me on Twitter. I was able to direct message with Bret Easton Ellis and ask him to recommend books to me, which he did.
Here's what we're going
to
do. You ready for this? You're going to talk to Peter Jackson and Bret Easton Ellis, and we're going to do Less Than Zero of the Rings. And it's basically... Mary and Sam and Frodo and then it's basically all of them, it's just the Less Than Zero story but with hobbits.
That sounds like a brilliant film.
I think we really needed to make this happen.
And Elijah was actually saying to me, I saw him last week, Elijah said, we were talking about the power of Twitter, and he was like, "Dude, like, I'm gonna slightly make his story a little bit vague on purpose." He said that there was a film that you heard about, which was not able to be released for some reason. It was held back by the studio and stuff. And he then went on Twitter and said, "Hey guys, I heard about this film a couple of years ago. I'd really love to see it. I heard that it's kind of locked up with the studio and they're not releasing it. Does anyone know anything about it?" The director then started following Elijah. They direct message with each other. And he was like, "Elijah, you know, can you help me out? If you could raise the awareness about it, that would be great." So then Elijah continued to tweet about it. And now the director's in a position where he's able to talk to the studio and hopefully wrangle it out of the studio just from a little Twitter exchange.
That's what I was saying before about the Twitter genie is that, I mean, it helps if you are fortunate enough to have a lot of followers. But if I'm trying to locate something, or if I have a question about something that I feel that is too specific for Google to really give the practical knowledge, it's good. You know, if it's a specific, you know, like when I was first, you know, working on doing the Nerdist website, if it was a coding question or like a specific error message or some type of, you know, if you guys run into this problem with WordPress, like stuff like that, you'd get information. customer service has been really great. And almost you have to be careful not to abuse that, because you don't want to be the guy that's complaining at his followers all the time about, you know, oh, I, you know, this airline fucked me over. Like, you don't want to be that guy, because then people are like, fuck you. But one thing that that did kind of make me go, holy shit, about the power of Twitter, which was a friend of my mom's has a daughter who needed a kidney. And they had a Facebook post. My mom said, can you post this on Twitter? And I said, sure. And they fucking found a donor.
That's amazing.
Like, that to me was...
That's life-saving stuff?
I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, yeah, that's
and
great.
And it's not... And, you know, my mom was like, oh, my God, thank you so much for doing this. Like, thank me for doing this. I just... I wrote a sentence. Like, I didn't even... I didn't do anything.
Yeah,
I
just...
I can't even really take responsibility for it.
That's
when you see the power of it and you go, oh my God, when it works the right way. And that's the thing about Twitter, is that it doesn't necessarily work the way all the businesses and the marketing people want. Like, they think, okay, well, all you got to do is just tweet out something. And, you know, if you have a million followers, then a million people are going to show up at this one time. And it's like, nah.
Yeah.
It doesn't really work that way. Twitter's real power is in the pyramid of your network.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you have 100,000 people following you, but each of those people only has one person following them, your pyramid's very shallow.
Right.
But if you have 1,000 people following you, but those 1,000 people each have 1,000 or more people following them, then that's where the network gets really powerful. They're going to retweet it to their 1,000 and their 1,000 and so forth. And then all of a sudden it becomes like a crazy pyramid scheme.
Yeah, yeah. I read that Justin Bieber has over 20 million followers.
Do you mind if I just give a kiss to Joan?
Yeah, of course.
I want to do your show. I would love to. Okay. I love you.
Legend.
She is. I'm sorry. Whenever I catch Joan walking by, I have to.
No, it's all good.
I have to make out with the window.
I'd like to make out with the window right now, actually.
So when Justin Bieber tweeted something?
I read that Justin Bieber has over 20 million followers and that he gets 40,000 followers a day.
Oh, fucking crazy.
That's insane, huh?
I hope they help him.
He also has a monkey.
that is stuck in quarantine.
Yeah, that's a bummer.
I mean, the trick... Here's the thing, that always seems to be the marker of, oh, everything might not be okay. If you remember when Michael Jackson got a chimp, that's when people started going, you know, he's got a monkey. You know,
Paris Hilton got some sort of strange lemur at one point, like a bizarre.
No, that was Nicole Richie.
Oh, was it? Some sort of, crazy tiny little marmoset or monkey type thing. I think there's a few things happening with that. First of all, like, you're not probably making the best responsible decisions because you're traveling a lot. You're living in your own bubble. How is that monkey gonna
bubble? Well done.
How is that monkey gonna deal with that crazy life? But the more scary thing for me in terms of their state of mind is it almost affects this slightly Machiavellian thing. Like, I am so powerful, I will have my own monkey servant.
I will command the wild animal kingdom. Yes. You know, like Hugh Hefner had monkeys at the Playboy Man. It's like, it's always, and I get it. Like, they're cool. You want to have it, like, they're neat. But
It's irresponsible, though.
It is irresponsible. We're not fucking kings, you know? Like, we should not have wild animals living in domestic situations.
No, and there are a lot. I mean, me personally, there's almost an infinite amount of cool animals out there that in so many different fantasy worlds I would love to keep. I'd love to have a fucking Black Panther. Can you imagine rolling up at a club with a Black Panther? Like, we're full tonight. I'm like, okay, I'm pretty sure my Black Panther wants to come in, and
either the animal or the militant group. Either one, you're getting into that club.
It's gonna cause some sort of problem.
Either one.
You know, tigers and crocodiles and all those things, they're amazing animals, but they are much more powerful, beautiful, and at peace when they're in their own habitat.
You know, it's funny. I was just having a conversation with a group of people the other day about how much I hated Curious George.
Right.
Because it's like, it is the Curious George is the saddest story of a monkey who was living happily, and then a fucking guy, some American guy in a yellow suit with a giant, I have, you know, I'm a big American hat, comes and takes him.
Kidnaps him.
And then a lot of the tales of Curious George are him being sad and just trying to get away.
Yeah.
Because he probably wants to go back home.
No, oh, it's a bummer, Curious George.
Yeah. And hey, how's it going? It's such a bummer that that people look at animals and they're like, oh, I should just own that. And you're like, well, should it not be in its natural habitat with other like creatures? And so I think this is a natural but organic segue to your show is that, you know, if people see your show, they're like, why is that actor playing around with all those animals? But they might not know that this is actually a lifelong pursuit of yours.
Yeah.
And not just a situation where a network said, we're doing an animal show. You're famous. Do you want to do an animal show? You brought this to, like, this was something that you always wanted to do.
Yeah. And I would challenge pretty much anyone out there to have those amazing experiences that I've had and behave and interact in the way that I did without it being one of the more important things in your life. Like, you can't be casual about putting your safety at risk and doing a show like that unless it is a real passion project. You know, I mean, I really danced around with it. I mean, I've loved animals all my life. I've kept a lot of different animals all my life, but I'm an actor, you know, and my ambitions in my career outside of Wild Things are so incredibly strong and not anywhere near fulfilled yet. I mean, obviously I've had the opportunity to work with some real luminaries in the business, but you know, I want to work with Spielberg. I want to work with Scorsese. I want to work with Aronofsky and Paul Thomas Anderson and all these amazing auteur directors. And I was very, very nervous and still am a little nervous about the idea of moving into what is now seen to be a kind of hosting gig, because I don't want people to go, oh, he's a host now. You know, I mean, I've ran into that at the start of this year. People are going, oh, so you're hosting now. That's your deal. Like, so if Ryan Seacrest doesn't do anything, maybe they'll ask you to do stuff. I'm like, no,
one thing. I just did a thing.
It was a passion project, something that I love, something that I believe in. And excuse me, I would do other passion projects. I'd certainly do a show about football, about soccer. I'd do a show about amazing restaurants around the world. I'm a foodie nut, you know, but the animal thing's at the top of the list in terms of a passion project. And I think the death of Steve Irwin was a huge deal for me because I loved his work. But that was the trigger to go, okay, well, if you don't do it now, when are you going to do it? And what does that say about how you felt about Steve Irwin's death, which was devastating to me? But more than anything else, the gift for me of standing in my garden and experiencing that moment with animals, whatever that may be on a daily basis, whether that's me just watching a bee go pollinate a flower and fly away, or watching a bobcat run through Griffith Park, or picking up a rattlesnake, whatever those tiny little interactions are with the natural world, it's so fulfilling to me. I imagine myself as like a glass of water that's half full, and then when I have these interactions, I feel it fill up. I feel it do something to me in the same way that it might if you were to see a loved one or hear from someone who you've not heard from for a while or have an amazing experience, you know. So making a show about it selfishly for me was huge, but I also, and that's what's been amazing about Twitter, Chris, is I wanted people to feel differently about those animals and feel differently about travel and football and street food. People are really scared of things like street food. They're scared to eat on the street. Now, that might be true in certain parts of LA where you might not want to do it, but in certain parts of Asia, that's the only way to eat. You don't go to restaurants in the day. They're closed. No one's in there.
Yeah.
And at nighttime, you wouldn't go there either. There's no scene. What you want to do is walk through the streets, grab something real quick in your hands, continue to walk around, walk down the banks of the river and stuff. And that's the cleanest, freshest way to eat. But there's a lot of myths that are associated with those things, you know? So I wanted to break some of those myths, you know?
So you're breaking food myths, animal myths, soccer hooligan myths.
Yes, very important. And the actor myth. I mean, you know, I think there are, you know, in any profession. There are people who are exceptional at their job. There are people that drag their way through it. There are people that have other interests. There are people that are only interested in that job. You know, I mean, J.J. Abrams is a director, but he also has an inordinate amount of interest in so many different things. And I think some people just assume that directors just go to work and, you know, work on set and that's their life. But also the same with actors. Some actors are just kind of, you know, model-y type folks that happen to look good on camera and they do an okay job at learning their lines. And other actors have, you know, someone like Marlon Brando was profound in so many different ways. And I'm nowhere near that level by any means. But what I also wanted to show was like, there isn't a one-dimensional element to anyone. And there isn't a one-dimensional element to me. I'm an actor. It's an interest of mine. I'm also interested in people and places and travel and things and animals. And
you do seem to keep landing these jobs that put you in exotic locations.
Yeah, yeah.
You go to New Zealand, you go to Hawaii, go to Vietnam. And
yeah, yeah. I mean, I do like travel. I traveled all my life. I mean, you know, I was born in Berlin, Germany, moved to Dusseldorf when I was 4, moved to Munster, another part of Germany, when I was 8 or 9, moved back to Manchester, where my parents are from, until I was 17, then started moving all around the country working, lived in Ireland, lived in France, lived in New Zealand, you know, traveled everywhere. So it's just part of my blood. And I don't know, people are people, you know. I like that element as well. I mean, I don't speak a lot of the languages in these countries, and we've been in some pretty dodgy situations where no one understands us. We don't understand them. They're obviously asking for things like money or food, or we have to give them something to get to the next place. And what you notice if you engage with those people and you smile and you have eye contact and you connect is that, you know, they're all just people.
So you should not start yelling and flapping your arms wildly.
Yeah, yeah. Don't start.
With your evil blue eyes. What do you not understand?
Don't get physically violent.
Why do they keep shooting our party?
You know, I mean, that's one of the real amazing experiences about going away and doing wild things is that, you know, people are people, kids are kids. They all just want to play. They want to have fun. They want to laugh. If you show them a rubbish magic trick that they know it's not magic. They know it's a trick. They all want to laugh and have fun. They all want to try it. You know, I mean, things like, you know, like my hair in Africa, like little kids would lose their mind putting their hands in my hair because they don't have hair like that in Africa, you know. Looking at your eyes, they don't have eyes like that. And then you pick up a football, you go play football with them. They're all like running around screaming. And these are kids who, you know, obviously have really tough lives. They don't necessarily know where their food's coming from. They don't know where their water's coming from. They're scantily clad. They're going through different levels of, you know, health concerns. And you think, wow, in the West, these kids would be hospitalized and they'd be in a real tough way. And in Africa, they're like, yeah, it's just life. We'll just get on with it. Instead of living to our 80s, we might live to our 40s, but at least we had a good time doing it. You know, I mean, I got a lot of admiration seeing those people, you know.
And so you obviously people who travel a lot tend to have a little bit more dimension than people who don't leave their own town for their whole lives, because you kind of need to. I mean, and it's really amazing that we take it for granted all the time, but really just in the last, you know, century in the history of humanity has travel been pretty much available to everyone. Mm. I mean, you could take boat trips before and people could get around, you know, if you were, but now you really can, you know, with a few small hurdles, anyone can pretty much go anywhere.
Yeah.
And we don't. Because it's scary.
A lot of people don't. I mean, I was with a friend from LA who I took on a business trip to Germany. And we were at a table of probably 12 to 14 people. And the bill came in, the check. And obviously we were in Germany. And we're all pulling out our money. And my friend said, don't they take real money? And I said, what do you mean? She said, don't they take dollars? And I said, first of all, real money. The Deutschmark has been around infinitely longer than the dollar. And why would you want that? Why would you be so demonstrative with your nationality to be like, well, I've never been so offended in my life. They don't take real money.
I think that's probably why Americans don't typically have the best reputation other places, because we're pretty, you know, our country is large enough and we're kind of isolated. And so we are, in a sense, we're sort of spoiled children in that way. And we're like, why can't everything just be that, you know? And so it's funny to go to like Europe and stuff. And then just to talk to people about what their idea of like the typical American is. They're like, oh, doesn't everyone have a cowboy hat and shoot guns? And you know,
the typical Americans, like, you know, the 10-gallon hat and the
loud,
the huge camera lens and stuff like that. I mean, I've lived in LA now for 10 years and I absolutely love America. It's an amazing country and fascinating in so many different ways. I love the positivity here. I love the people here. They're so nice. The service industry is amazing. The choice of food and the way that they treat you is fantastic. But the travel element is something that you guys don't do that much. I mean, for me, travel is all about the escape. It's about escaping what you know. I don't want my own currency. I don't want my own language. I don't want my own food. I don't want my own schedule. I want to do different stuff. And I think a lot of people, not necessarily Americans, just a lot of people, I mean, English people are guilty of this terribly in places like Spain and Greece and France. They want to go from England, fly to a place that has better weather, but eat an English breakfast and eat, you know, shepherd's pie and have a Sunday roast on a Sunday. And you're like, just stay in England, just get a sunbed and, you know, like...
I need to beat your breakfast in your sunbed. Food,
you know, so people feel differently about travel and it's like a fear thing as well. I mean, there are things that I'm scared of because they're genuinely scary. Like if I was in the ocean and I saw a shark, it would scare me. But I also am aware that, to a certain degree, walking towards things that are unknown, walking towards things that you are potentially scared of has a real element of value to it. The payoff is huge, you know? And I think there's something about that with travel. You step into the unknown and you come out the other side a different person. That is huge for, like, at a cellular level. I think that's a big deal, you know?
But I still think it's important. I imagine it's still important to be as prepared as you can be.
Sure.
And not just like, oh, I'm just going to walk into that den over there. You know, like there's a different, I think some people misinterpret that. They're like, oh, I shouldn't jump out of a high speed vehicle. No. I know that's unknown. No, you still have to take, precautions and right. Still be smart, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, it's another thing about Twitter. You know, people say to me, how could you pick up that spider? How could you pick up that snake? Aren't you scared you're going to get bit? Why do you go around just picking up all these animals? I mean, the drama of the show, the kind of the conceit almost of the show is to say to the audience, this is very much more dangerous than what is actually occurring, you know, because like, for instance, the snake in the tree, this huge 14-foot python in this tree in the Laos episode.
When you're going to look for the water bug.
Yeah, when I go look for the water bug. Oh, in Vietnam. You know, I didn't estimate that it was going to be that big. I thought it was probably going to be about 8 feet or so. It's much bigger than I expected. But I did pay close attention to its attitude very early on in the scene. And I knew very quickly that this was a snake that wasn't going to get tweaked. It wasn't going to suddenly bite me and lose its mind and cause a massive scene. It was relaxed. Its heart rate was very chilled out. It was calm. I'm not going to say that on the show. I'm not going to say to the viewers, hey, this massive snake is actually just a teddy bear, so don't even worry about the scene. We want to create drama. We want to show you that it's exciting. You know, in some of the scenes with the cobra, we have me, the cobra, and then the camera in that order. Now, what that does for an audience watching it is it doesn't necessarily show you extremely accurately how close or how far away the cobra is to me. Cobra is much closer to me than it would be in a real safe scenario, but it's not as close as to be hugely dangerous. But the audience doesn't know that. But you wouldn't say that anyway. It's TV, you know?
Right.
I mean, someone again on Twitter said to me a couple of weeks ago, he said, I stopped watching your show because every time you say you're going to go look for something, you find it. And I go, yeah, that's the show. That's the drama of the show.
If you want to watch people looking for something and not finding it, watch Finding Bigfoot.
Exactly. Watch Walking Through a Forest for a Night. Like, there's an Indiana, we talked about Indiana Jones a lot when we were coming up with the idea for the show. He has a mission. He falls off. He gets distracted. He meets a beautiful woman. He meets a charismatic gentleman. He runs through a, you know, he does all these things that distract him, but his mission is, you know, that thing in the box, that thing in the tomb, whatever it is. I always have a target mission, what I'm doing, but I'm willing to let myself get swayed. But, you know, it's obviously a conceit to say to people in the show, you know, we're looking for it. I hope I find it. We don't know if we will find it. We're heading towards that end goal. Now, there's been times where we haven't necessarily found it in the way that we've wanted, or we haven't found it until the last minute, or what we're trying to do with the animal, we don't do. Look, with the bees, I was trying to harvest honey. Couldn't get anywhere near the bees when I got up there. Not only was I not going to move around 140 foot up in this tree, but the bees were so aggressive that anytime I did, you know, move my hand towards them, they just buzzed towards me. And I was like, we can't, like, these guys, these are, you know, 2 million bees. They're going to suffocate me at the very least to kill me.
Yeah.
So we couldn't do that. So sometimes the mission changes, but we always have a mission and we're always heading towards that mission.
It's funny because the same guy who complained at you for finding stuff every week, if you didn't find stuff every week, like, I'm going to stop watching your show because right. You don't find anything every week.
Jeez Louise.
Have you had to respond to people? Because even when Steve Irwin died, I noticed that there were people who were like, well, he shouldn't have been fucking around with animals. Mm. You know, like, is there a, you know, have people responded that way where they're like, you, who do you think you are to go and start touching animals? Maybe they don't want to be.
Yeah, I have. And, you know, with respect, but not that much respect, I would say that that is the ignorance of that person. I mean, if you knew anything about Steve Irwin, you knew that he was highly educated in terms of animal behavior.
Yeah.
He was a trained herpetologist. He was someone who had spent his entire life with dangerous animals. He was responsible. He knew exactly what he was doing. He was involved in a freak occurrence, you know?
Yeah.
I'm in no way near as qualified as Steve Irwin, but to the guy on the street, I have a general knowledge that is much better in terms of how to approach a snake, how to approach a spider, how to approach a scorpion, and do it safely. Do I put myself in harm's way? Yeah, but I don't do it in a way that ever manipulates the animal to make it feel bad. As soon as we know that the animal's having a tough time or is getting overly stressed, we just stop the scene, you know, and I'm kind of the animal guy on set. So with my crew, I'll say to them, this is the distance that you can come towards the animal. This is what we're going to use as like a safety word. This is when we're going to throw down all our equipment and run. And the animal is the king in that scene, you know. Also, like, you know, I don't want to die by any means. I love my life. I love what I'm doing. And, you know, I want to be a granddad and sit in a rocking chair and, you know, tell my grandchildren about all the adventures that I've been on and find out about all their adventures. But in a slightly more cosmic way of thinking about it, my relationship with the natural world is something that I value and love. And if in some way my exploring of that relationship involves me heading down an avenue that in which I don't come back from, I've made my peace with being okay with that particular thing. I don't want to do this by any means, but look, if I got killed in a car accident, I would be super fucking bummed out. if I died doing what I love in this nature show, or, you know, died on set acting, like, I would hope my friends and my peers around me would say, it's a bummer that he died, hopefully. But he died doing what he loved. Who doesn't want to die doing what they love, you know? So I don't want that to be like an epitaph or anything. I'm just saying, like, I'm cool with it, you know? I'm cool with it. I know that when I handle a cobra, there's a chance that I'll get bit. If I get bit, I'm willing to take those health concerns because I'm responsible and I've made that choice. I would never get bitten by a cobra and go, I can't believe this happened to me. I can't believe you guys would let me do this. Like, I know the risks.
Why does everything happen to me?
Exactly.
Well, cobra.
You know what I was going to ask, because I know this podcast reaches far and wide, and it reaches far and wide into the world that could help me out. I've been looking for a film for probably 10 years now.
Okay.
It's called The Flight of the Dragons.
Okay.
It's an animated film, probably mid-1970s to late 1970s. It's got a Bakshi-like animated quality. John Earl James. James Earl John? John Earl James?
James Earl Jones, the actor James Earl Jones?
James Earl Jones plays the evil dragon in it. And it's the story of a young man who, plays a board game called The Flight of the Dragons and falls into the board game and finds when he's in the board game, he becomes a dragon that has to eat gold, learn how to fly, battle this bad dragon. It was one of my brother and I's favorite films when we were a kid. We had it on, I don't even think we had it on VHS. I think we kept borrowing it. from the video shop on VHS. I don't think it's ever made its way to DVD. But if anyone has it on DVD and they get in touch with you, I'd be willing to do some sort of swap.
Sure.
Lord of the Rings, Blu-ray, DVD swap.
Lost. You have to come live with us for a year. What?
What?
Well, how bad weird. Do you want it?
Yeah.
All right.
Let's see if anyone has it. There's some movie collectors out there, right?
Oh, I'm sure someone will be able to find it. Have you not been to like Rocket Video or Mondo or any of the...
I've been to a couple of places in LA, video stores. They've not had it. I've been to that place on Sunset that stocks.
I feel good about this because you know the name, you know the cast. Like it's better than like, oh, there was this dragon thing.
Yeah. Someone's got it. What Flight about you? Do you have anything like that in your life? Anything vague where you're like, I don't know what this is, but I...
A lot of times for me, it's songs, which it's impossible because unless if they're obscure, the only thing that you have is what people had for generations before ours, which is that I would have to sing it and go, no, it's the da-na-na-na-na, and then you hope someone goes... Oh, yeah, that.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's really hard with a song because there's no context. And so, like, I don't know when it was released. I don't know what the band is. I just have the melody in my head.
Oh, you just have the melody. You don't have lyrics.
Yeah,
so lyrics.
I just have a couple songs with their melodies in my head. And I've just kind of gotten comfortable. Like, that part of my brain, which I would normally be able to scoop that out and just clear out that space, I know that I may live my whole life, and the only way that I'll ever find out what those songs are now is if I happen to be in the right place at the right time and it comes on a speaker, and then I can quickly now go to the phone and Shazam it or something, and or just yell, does anybody know what this is?
Yeah, yeah.
But that's, you know, so you at least have the luxury of
that's
like,
true.
Yeah, this is a movie, people are going to know what this movie is, and someone out there will find this movie.
A little bit more to go on with me. I've had a lot of like classical songs in my head that I can't place, because you can't just go onto Google, put in a line,
no,
and it'll spit it out. I just let you have a piece of a melody, and I'm like, oh, shit. I don't know
that. You almost might have to learn to play piano and then start playing it for people.
Yeah, yeah. I was doing, on the way over here, The Imperial March from Star Wars as a cricket. Do I hear that?
Yes, I really do.
Make sure I'm not too close to the mic.
Okay.
Come here. Get some water. You have to slightly moisten your lips, gentlemen.
You're listening to cricket concerts on K-Nerdist. Coming up is a selection of The Imperial March by the cricket band Dominic Monaghan.
Thank you. Pretty good, right?
Don't forget that we will be handing out stickers at the book fair.
It just feels like a classical station.
What is it with those classical DJs where everything's just so... Welcome to Radio 4.
I know my friend Steve Callahan, we did comedy in college together, and now he fucking runs Family Guy. But he used to have this bit, when we were in college where he would do the... it was the monster truck pull on the classical station. There you go.
Don't forget to come out this Sunday. Big Daddy Bart and Truckzilla will be here.
That's Steve Callahan's bit.
Every single one of my alerts on my phone is something from Steve.
Well, the classic radio DJ is the guy, like, it's almost like the MO behind it is someone, they don't want to disturb their audience, they don't want to upset their audience likes this ambient, gorgeous, you know, lyricless music. And so they always sound like someone who's just creeped in the room to be like,
I'm just gonna check on you before you go to bed. I'm sorry. Just wanted you to know that was Mozart.
Yeah, yeah.
Just wanted you to know before that was Chopin.
Yeah, yeah.
With Etude number 10. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, backing away. Better turn the lights out.
And they just get very...
Yeah.
I'm gonna watch you while you sleep.
As I've got older, I in no means do I know anything about classical music, but as I've got older, I mean, when I was, you know, in my late teens to early 20s, I just completely wrote off classical music. It's shit.
And now you get it.
It's boring. And now I'm like, that is lovely when I'm like hanging by my pool and I don't necessarily want to connect to something really deeply. I just want something in the background that's nice and, you know, makes me feel good in the sun and you know, jumping around in the water. And it's epic. I also watch two things. There's a great website called topdocumentaryfilms.com. It just has free scrolling films.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, and there's two films on there, one called The Genius of Beethoven and The Genius of Mozart, that is just spellbinding. I mean, what those guys did, you know, I mean, they're both geniuses in a lot of different ways, but I mean, just some of the ideas that these guys had in terms of music. I mean, you could argue that, well, I would argue that for me, Beethoven's more interesting, not only the fact that he went deaf and wrote his greatest pieces when he was deaf, but also like he, from an intellectual point of view, started to do stuff like, okay, I've achieved that. Now I'm going to do it in reverse with both hands moving inwards and then both hands moving outwards, just to see if I can do it. Just from a kind of physical point of view, can I achieve that thing? And, oh man, those guys just blow my mind.
Well, it is, and when you look at classical music, you really understand how mathematical music is.
Right.
Just in, you know, all of these pieces have to be placed here, and then on these spaces we'll place here, but they're in perfect... Mm. In, you know, intervals.
Yeah.
And so it's, I love how mathy music is.
Yeah.
Like that to me makes it really fucking
cool. So you would imagine someone at that level of pure genius like Beethoven and Mozart in a modern day world would be doing, they'd be doing the Rubik's Cube while doing Sudoku, whilst doing a podcast. You know, they're that kind of brain, you know, that kind of amazing thing.
Do you play anything?
I play a little guitar and a little piano. But not enough, certainly not enough piano to impress anyone. I'm always really deflated. Like people, I give people a tour of my house and they see my piano. I go, oh, you have a piano? I go, yeah. They go, oh, can you play? I go, oh, I can play a little thing. They go, play us something, play. And I go,
they think you're being modest. You're like,
shit. Okay, so then I'll play something. It's always super underwhelming. They're like, all right, let's go look around the garden or something. You know,
oh, you really don't know how to play. Yeah, I know. I told you that before.
Yeah.
But you guilted me into
it. Just forced me into doing it. Yeah.
What did you do? Did you go crazy in Hawaii at all?
Crazy.
I mean, in the sense of, you know, like I remember one of the first times I ever talked to Damon Lindelof about Lost, and someone asked him, we were doing a panel, and someone said, like, well, you know, how come this character went away or what happened with this? And he goes, look, we have like, we have an idea overall of where we want to go. But a show is made up of actors, and sometimes those actors, I think he was referring specifically to the guy who played Mr. Echo. And so he was like, he goes, he got there and then decided he didn't want to be in Hawaii all the time anymore. And so then I thought, well, who wouldn't want to be in Hawaii all the time? And I think, well, I guess if you're there for 9 months and there's not, and then you've kind of done everything and then you're sort of isolated from the, I don't know, maybe, you know, did you enjoy the process or?
Excuse me. I think I had a few things working in my favor because as someone who traveled all their life, I was fine picking up my stuff and just transplanting it in Hawaii.
And you would also go off and play with snakes.
I'd also go off and play with all the, you know, species in Hawaii. And I was a surfer because I learned to surf in New Zealand, got to become friends with a guy called Kalani Rob, who's from Hawaii, professional surfer. So he and I were, you know, friends and we hung out. You know, I was falling in love in Hawaii. So I spent like the first few years just blissfully in love.
So it was nice for you.
So there was things about it that worked. I mean, we also benefited from, like, you know, Lost exploded in so many different kind of pop culture ways, but being isolated on an island, you didn't feel it quite as much. And I think if we had filmed the show in LA, some of the slightly more kind of egotistical personalities on the show would have been way more irritating if they weren't living on an island where there's like four good restaurants and one good club.
It's too bad. And I always say this of any show that's successful where you just go, guys, it's really hard to get a show on the air. It's really hard to keep a show on the air. It's nearly impossible to have a hit show. Is there any way that maybe we could just enjoy this process and not get all fucking crazy and heady about it?
I mean, you know, I don't like bashing Lost because it's an amazing show. I had an incredible experience on it, and it's a fantastic show. I think that is, I would say, for me at least, the first episode of Lost can go up against the first episode of any show out there, and the first season of Lost can go up against any first season. I think it's almost perfect pop cultural rich pulpy TV. You know?
I always say when people ask me about Talking Dead and they're like, oh, could you, what other shows did you want to do an after show for? I was like, I wish I had the show for Lost.
Yeah, yeah.
I wish I had had an after show for Lost to sift through everything. Because you would watch and then you would forget stuff and you're like, oh my God, the Black Rock. I fucking totally forgot about that thing from two seasons ago. And here it is. Like, there was just so much information to sift through.
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff. Great characters, great arcs for these characters, and I think everyone did really, really fantastic work throughout it, from the writers and the producers and the directors all the way through the actors. What started to irk me on Lost was essentially, within reason, a large cast of unknowns started the show. I mean, you know, Harold Perrineau had a relatively successful career, and Terry O'Quinn, and I was lucky enough to come off of Lord of the Rings at the time, mm-hmm. but, you know, most people had really not done a huge amount, apart from maybe this one moment that was great, and then, you know, jobbing actors. And within the course of, you know, 6 months or so, some of those personalities went from, I really need a job to continue to be an actor, to, I can't fucking believe that I'm not on Letterman. What is going on? And I remember just thinking, man, like, what is happening here? Like, you're in Hawaii. This is an amazing show. You're having a great time. Like, just, it's happening. It is all happening right now. All those things that you wanted are happening right now. And I think maybe you just want to moan, you know? But I had a great time on Lost. And I was happy that I played a character that had a small amount of significant movements throughout the story. I mean, what I had worried about sticking around with Charlie was that I would just fall back into the background and be kind of a glorified babysitter and, you know, an in and out.
Oh, he had such a struggle, though. And there was Claire and heroin and music. And you rooted for him. You just rooted for him so much.
Yeah, and I like the fact that he burnt bright and then faded away. There was a rock and roll element to his personality on the show. He arrived with a bang. He made his, you know, presence felt. And, you know, he left a good-looking corpse. I think that is the story of, like, a rock and roll guy. No one else could have been that rock and roll, you know?
Not so. Penny's Boat. One final.
Oh, yeah, I love
one
that.
Final. Oh, my God, that was so...
And I get that on Twitter, like, well, I don't know, 20 or 30 times a day.
I even did it. I did it on Talking Dead. Like, Damon was on, and I did it coming back from commercial.
Someone will go on Twitter, they'll write, not Penny's Boat, remember? And I'm like... Yeah.
No, you should just be like, what is that?
Yeah, what does that even mean? I don't
understand.
Does that correlate to, is that a Star Wars line or something?
Penny, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. But between that, I mean, you know, and being, you were in New Zealand the entire time for Lord of the Rings?
Yeah, so we're in New Zealand, like just under 2 years for principal photography. And then we went back for 3 years running for like 8 weeks at a time to do reshoots.
That's a considerable percentage of your life.
Mm. Yeah, and you know, I still have a very close relationship with Pete, and I mean, you know, some of the people in that kind of field, like, you know, Pete and JJ are the people that I'm probably the tightest with in terms of who I've worked with up to now. And with Pete, you know, he's, you know, one of the more powerful people in the business, but he's also someone that I can email him about Doctor Who, or I can email him about my show, or I can ask him what his kids are up to, or, you know, there's a genuine personal relationship there with someone who has created some real movie magic, you know? And also, what was great about that whole adventure with Pete was that at no point did Pete kind of take on this mantle of, like, I'm Peter Jackson, I directed Lord of the Rings, I am a movie god. You know, he never did that. He was always like, wow, this is great, huh? Like, this is amazing.
You can't help but love the guy. I moderated the Hobbit panel last year at Comic-Con, and he was awesome. And then also, and of course you find out, like, he's a massive Doctor Who fan. Huge. And wants to do something on Doctor Who. And you're like, oh, my God.
Yeah, yeah, he's a big geek. I mean, in the greatest way to say that word. I mean, you know, I have geeky elements about my personality that I'm into, too. And, you know, Pete has huge amounts of storage rooms that he's turned into museums, and they're just full of model ships and model airplanes, and he and I are massive Beatles fans, and he has some, like, costumes from Yellow Submarine, costumes from Sgt. Pepper's.
Holy shit.
Yeah, yeah, costumes from, like, that John Lennon wrote, lyrics of John Lennon's. He has correspondence between Charlie Chaplin and his agent, Orson Welles and his agent, Errol Flynn and his agent, like, and we were just walking around. He was like, oh, Dom, check this out, you'll love it. Little shoebox of open envelopes. And I was like, this? And he went, yeah, yeah, I just leaf through a few things. I was like, okay, open them up. And it's just Marilyn Monroe and her agent, Ernest Hemingway and his agent, Errol Flynn and his agent. I'm like, oh, I'm going to steal this, Pete, if you don't mind.
Should I be touching this? But when you look at the directors, you know, like J.J., Guillermo, Peter Jackson, and you see, you know, because I've been to Bad Robot before, and it's just like all these toys and all this awesome Twilight Zone stuff, and Guillermo has all this crazy stuff at his house and a room that he's built that's where it's simulating rain outside all the time, and because he just likes the rain, and he's got a bunch of toys and a bunch, and to hear that, I get so much more excited about those stories, and it makes me love their work more, because then you go, yeah, it's not a job. Like, they're doing, like, they're just expressing as a career the stuff that they actually love. Mm. Whereas, I mean, listen, Michael Bay might be a nerd. He's probably a tit nerd.
Right, right.
He's probably not.
Or a money nerd.
Or yeah. A money nerd, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's probably not the cool collection of, you know, robots and stuff where you go with the guy who directed Transformers. I don't know. I don't know him at all. Maybe he does like all that stuff. I'm just saying when I see – he seems more of like a jock type of dude. And when I see like nerds who make good, it makes me happy. Because like, yes, you should be directing that. You should get this stuff. You should have this success. You're one of us and you're sort of leading the charge and you're doing the things you care about. That's inspiring in that way.
It is, yeah. And I think what an interesting correlation between those three people, JJ, Pete, and Guillermo, is – they were doing what they loved at a very young age, and they continued to do it. You know what I mean? Both JJ, Guillermo, and Pete were making small model monsters when they were 7, 8, 9 years old. And I would guess that all three of them, if they ever have any spare time, probably still do the same thing.
Probably.
And they now just do it on a grand scale. Pete was making little war soldiers when he was a kid. Then he was able to film the Battle of Helm's Deep. He's just doing it on a grander scale because he has more of an imagination, more money, more opportunity to do it on a bigger scale.
And they would still be doing that shit even if they never became...
Yeah, they would.
Successful. They would still be... I think they would still be doing that stuff.
I think they would. I mean, you know, there is something to be said. There's a great advantage about knowing what you wanted to do at a young age. I mean, I saw Empire Strikes Back first before Star Wars when I was a kid, and then the week after, I saw Indiana Jones... I saw Raiders of the Lost Ark, and I put it together that Harrison Ford was Han Solo in Indiana Jones, and worked out at the age of 7 or 8, which is no great intellectual accomplishment at all, that that it was a job. That they didn't just have cameras on Dantooine and they were filming it. You know, it was a film. And once I realized that, I thought I'm gonna do that. And then I realized, oh, I actually have to try and do that and make progress to do that. But I had that drive when I was a kid, something that I definitely knew what I wanted to do. There were people way more intelligent than I was at school, way more gifted, way more applied than I was, people who were getting straight A's across the board, who didn't really know what they wanted to do and have only really worked out in their mid-30s. Meanwhile, in my late teens to early 20s, I was making the mistakes that you should make when you're doing it professionally, when I was just with my friends messing around. So if you know what you want to do at a young age, you just get a head start on so many things, you know.
Well, you're also lucky too, because of the way that you grew up and the way that you are, is that you're sort of like a cat. Like, someone could just drop you anywhere and you're probably going to land on your feet, because you know how to travel, you understand situations. Like, so, you know, being on a movie set or doing, like, taking a, you have real life experiences that you're able to acclimate to and be, like you said, like, oh, no one speaks the language and we have to make sure that we don't offend these people and kind of get what we want. You have that awareness.
Oh,
you understand how to work any environment, what a gift.
Yeah, yeah. I am the king of the Jedi mind trick as well. I'm not kidding. I have a couple of physical and mental techniques that I use that are like Jedi mind tricks that are powerful, you know.
Where's your infomercial? Why are you not selling this as a program?
I don't want everyone else to know about it, but like, I've found myself in situations, you know, sometimes you'll get yourself into a situation where you're not comfortable, you need to leave, you need to know where the exits are, that kind of stuff. And I'll sometimes apply a couple of small Jedi mind tricks, and they work. They're interesting. And we were talking about last week on the show where, because, like, you know, with you and I have a certain level of visibility in the general public, you can use that to your advantage when someone can't quite place you. You can flip it on them and gain the advantage, because it's all about, like, if you're ever in any kind of, you know, obviously physical danger, getting the upper hand or throwing the first punch is a really important thing to do, because then you have control of the situation. To some extent, you're dictating, you're in the driver's seat. So I haven't been in that situation too much, but I have been in a lot of situations where I know that I need to kind of exert some level of control to either leave or escape or not have someone do something that they want to do. And because you're in that slightly elevated position, they'll make assumptions that you just don't have to confirm for them. You know, you just like, you don't necessarily need to confirm or not that the person that you're talking to on the phone is or isn't your 280-pound bodyguard who's just stood outside. You know, you can just kind of drop that into the ether and let them deal with it as they want to, you know?
I like to think that the snake in Vietnam was a huge Lost fan, and that's why it didn't murder you.
Yeah.
Oh, this guy's giving me so much joy over there. I can't murder him. I could break his spine. Yeah. I'm 18 feet long.
You know, the spiders, and we do a lot of spiders and snakes because the myth element associated with those animals is something that really bums me out. You know, I mean, I was talking to some girls. I was at BBC America yesterday. I was talking to some girls who said that they were both terrified of spiders, and what should they do and how should they deal with it? And I said, well, you got to go through a certain amount of steps. But I said, the first one for you guys to just try and, try and keep hold of when you see a spider is, unless you're within probably a foot and a half to 2 feet, not only is the spider not going to come towards you, but the spider really has no concept that you even exist. Doesn't know that you're there. I mean, if you breathe on it, it's probably going to go, okay, I smell or sense something in the air that's different. What's that about? But it's not going to go, ooh, human. Okay, cool. It's just going to go, wait, that there's an organic smell coming towards me that smells like food. Potentially, what is that? But you could stand next to a spider or sleep next to a spider all night, and unless you directly interacted with them, they just don't have the intellectual capability to go, human. Okay, here we go.
This will be a piece of cake. They're terrified of us.
Right. It's not in their wheelhouse. They don't think in that way. Spiders don't necessarily think in any particular way that we can understand. But, you know, the rudimentary ways that they do think is this something I can eat? Is this something that's going to eat me? Am I safe? That's pretty much. And I don't think they think that. It's just that's their reaction.
But, you know, with spiders and snakes in particular, there's just something biological in some people that some image has attached itself to their molecules.
Yes.
And no matter how much reasoning, if they see it, they're just like, yeah, like it just, it goes, their brain fires around their higher brain functions, just goes right to the lizard brain.
Yeah.
And it's fight or flight.
it definitely does do that. And I understand that. I understand it a little bit more when, excuse me, I would speak to someone and they would say, look, I'm scared of snakes because a snake killed my dad, or a snake killed someone in my village, or a snake bit my sister and she lost 3 fingers. I'd be like, okay, that is a significant reason to be scared of snakes. But someone living in Los Angeles who's terrified of vampire bats or crocodiles, you're like, well, you need to get a grip on just the amount of exposure you're going to have to that fear. Someone asked me on Twitter again, give me one good reason why I shouldn't be scared of sharks, and I said, because you're not aquatic, you know?
They're easy to avoid.
They're so easy to avoid on a general basis. I mean, more people are killed by, you know, washing machines than sharks, and we don't go, oh my god, the laundry, you know, like, it's just the perspective is whacked. And like I said, if I was swimming in the ocean and a great white or any type of shark to within reason was underneath me, circling me, that is a terrifying moment. I would be genuinely scared. If I saw a tiger in the forest of India, I would be scared. But I wouldn't not take a flight to India because tigers live there. That you were, our understanding of that fear is off, you know?
Yeah. Well, this has been a really fun hour.
Yeah, man, that was cool.
We covered soccer, we covered animals, we got a little Lost, we got a little Lord of the Rings, we got some travel knowledge.
You didn't really do Star Wars. Can I ask you a couple of questions on Star Wars before we finish?
Sure, yeah.
The JJ Star Wars thing in specifics.
Yeah.
Like, obviously you and I grew up on 4, 5, and 6, and then 1, 2, and 3 came around.
Correct.
If, now that we know, because I've been... you know, thinking about this a lot with people and talking about it a lot with people. Now that we know that JJ's jumping onto Star Wars, is there like, well, like, what are your specific concerns? What would you hope as someone who, JJ, I think, is in his early 40s, who obviously grew up with 4, 5, and 6 as well. What would you hope would be kind of the stance that he'd take? And like, where do you think that's all going?
I don't have any concerns about it because, and I do get asked, people, I've done a bunch of interviews with people like, are you worried about anything? I'm like, no, because what you have is now Star Wars is at a place where really accomplished directors, they're essentially going to be super high budget fan films, which it's a new perspective. It's a new take. You know, a guy like JJ, who was probably super inspired by Star Wars, that for the last 40 years of his life has probably been, you know, okay, 35 years of his life has probably been saying, oh my God, here's what I would do with Star Wars. I mean, like that motivation probably helped drive him to be a director.
Sure.
And now he has a chance to express that. And so I'm very excited about that.
Yeah.
He's probably, because, you know, I thought he made a good Star Trek movie and he didn't even really like Star Trek.
Right.
The series.
Yeah.
So he is about to go undertake something that he loves. I think I'm excited to see where it goes. And, you know, unlike a lot of the internet, I like to judge things before they, but I mean, I like to judge things after I see them and not before.
Sure.
Whereas the internet is like, oh my God, how good, what's happening? You know, like pieces of the internet are like, more Star Wars. Wait. I'm like, fuck yeah, more Star Wars.
Yeah.
And from a fresh perspective.
Yeah.
From a guy who loves it, who can't, you know, like, why wouldn't you want that? I think JJ's great. I would love to see Guillermo make a Star Wars movie because,
me too.
I mean, like, just the fucking creatures alone would be incredible.
What about, like, an Aronofsky Star Wars or, like, a Paul Thomas Anderson Star Wars? Like a Star Wars that's...
Anderson Star Wars.
Yeah, it's so rich in character, and it doesn't really move intergalactically that much, but you go into the nuances of the personalities and the... you know, the darkness of these characters.
Someone must have done like a Wes Anderson Star Wars where it's just like really long, like static shots of beautiful scenery. And then like an alter, like some sort of a ukulele song starts playing.
A voiceover comes
in. Yeah, exactly. I never knew what it would be like going down to Dagobah. But any today would be different. Dun, 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 dun. Yoda comes out in a tennis band.
you know, one of my favorite things about Star Wars growing up, 4, 5, and 6, and this just leaked into me without me really thinking about it, was the fact that everything felt so real. You know, the Millennium Falcon had bumps and scratches and dents on it, and the Death Star wasn't fully operational yet. And, you know, if you fell over, you would get hurt and people got scared and stuff like that. I think the Star Trek world in terms of films and the Star Wars world differs in the sense that there is a slick cleanness about the Star Trek world in a way. I mean, obviously JJ's made it get a little bit more dirtier, but what I loved about 4, 5, and 6, the original stuff, was that it was a world that you knew. It was a world that felt like you could touch and grab and feel, and that's what I'm hoping really happens with the JJ film, because I know that he goofs off on that stuff, is that, you know, if you see Tauntauns, or if you see Jabba the Hutt, or if you see a character that's a little disgusting, that they do have snot and they do have scars and they are covered in stuff. You know, I want to see it be a world that lives and breathes. You know, but I don't think there's anyone better than JJ to do it. Like, he's just, like you said, he's been a fan all his life, and you know, I think JJ probably feels that that weight on his shoulders of being a Star Wars fan all his life and it being one of the reasons why he is a director and now he's helming that ship. But I think also what I've noticed about JJ over the years is that he is more than willing to like step up to the plate. He's good with pressure. He deals with it. And he's going to want to deliver for his kids in the same way that Lucas delivered for him when he was a kid.
There's so much emotional investment for him as opposed to just a director that they've hired. Right. Like he is not just for his kids, but for himself.
Yeah.
He's not going to want to be the guy that ruins Star Wars.
No.
Not even just for the fans or for the box office, but for himself.
Totally.
So I feel good about it and I'm excited. And I think, you know, more Star Wars is more Star Wars. And it's, you know, like I'm sure over the years he's thought, here's what I would have done. Oh, I wouldn't have done that. Oh, maybe try this. He probably has it all. Like now his head is this fucking toy box that he finally gets to open and play with and go, finally.
Yeah.
Now I get to do all the stuff I always wanted to do.
Yeah.
And I'm excited to see that.
And supposedly I read this in Empire this month. I don't know if it features in Star Trek, but he said it. So maybe it does. JJ says that he's put a miniature R2-D2 in every single one of his films. So I hope it features in Star Trek somewhere. A miniature, like it's, you know, what is that? 10 centimeters?
Sure. Like so just somewhere hidden in everything.
Somewhere hidden. It's definitely in Super 8. It's definitely in Cloverfield. Can I give you my best Yoda impression when we finish?
Please.
Your weapons. You would not eat them.
That's really good. That's really good.
You know what people mess up with Yoda a lot is they do that.
Yeah.
But he only does that a couple of times and he's not the jolly guy that much. My favorite thing that Yoda does is when Luke has decided to leave the Dagobah system and Ben Kenobi says, then all is lost. And Yoda says, no, there is another. You're like, oh, who's the other one? That's rad, you know, but.
What if Yoda were calling a soccer match? We're here with comedians happening, but. You shouldn't have told me that you could do that because I'll just be like, oh, say this.
Yeah,
do my outgoing message.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what, you know what? How about this? What's the movie you're looking for? The Tale of the Dragon?
Oh, The Flight of the Dragons.
Flight of the Dragon. If you can find Flight of the Dragons for Dominic Monaghan, he will do your outgoing message as probably any character that you want, but I would choose Yoda if I were you.
Yeah, Yoda. I'll come into the Nerdist studio, I'll record it, and then we'll get it to you on the voicemail.
Love it. Perfect.
Sweet.
At Dom's Wild Things on Twitter, Wild Things, Dominic Monaghan on BBC America, and I think we covered everything.
Good to see you,
man. Good to see you too, man. Thanks for coming in.
Welcome.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone. You should tell everyone to enjoy their burrito because you have a much better accent than I do.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Fucking perfect. God damn it. Me and my stupid mashed up American accent. You can't even tell where I'm from. I'm regionless. Boring. Vanilla.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist.
Do you ever wonder what your teenager is going through when they're preparing to leave home and enter the real world? I'm Shima Liai, and in my new podcast, The Competition, I'll give you an inside look into the pressures and expectations high school girls have to face.
I think I need to make a good first impression, or at least an impressive first impression.
We're going to follow 50 teenage girls as they spend 2 weeks in Mobile, Alabama, competing in the largest cash scholarship competition exclusively for high school girls. You'll hear the silly, intimate moments.
Why are you so amazing?
Like, I want to be you guys.
And the anxiety that comes with being an ambitious girl in America.
My whole life, I've told myself that I need to be a 35-year-old professional.
Is the pressure too much to handle? From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.